I'm not really a midget, he's just tall. I have to believe that. I just have to, you know. I'm Burns Brady, and I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for the introduction. Thanks for y'all. Tony has a great deal of admiration and respect and love for me, and I can tell you I have a great deal of admiration and respect and love for him. Before Jen came on the scene, it was just him, and she came on the scene, and I can say that's true of both of them. In Kentucky, we do have the Healing Place, which we started roughly 1989. It's a homeless shelter for indigent street people. We started off sleeping 250 men a night. Now we sleep 500 men and women a night. We have them in a year-long program of recovery. It's not a treatment center. It's a recovery center, and we teach them the big book. That's literally what they're in there for. When we first started, it was for a year. And due to financial stuff, we cut it down to 6-7 months. But during that period of time, every day they studied the big book on a structured way of doing that. And then there was a doctor who was governor of Kentucky 6-8 years ago. He came down and bought the Healing Place model and decided to do a thing called Recovery Kentucky. And there are 15 units over the state, with each one of them having approximately 100 people in that. That means there are 1,500 homeless indigent people in the state of Kentucky in a six-month program studying the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous along with the people in Lexington. I'm giving you that background because Tony runs one of those units. And the fact that I love him and respect him and everything else is not the reason I'm saying this. It is the most significantly, consistently, spiritually disciplined program doing that. And if you've ever dealt with our population, indigent or not, you know that some sort of spiritual discipline is necessary. You just don't call a piccolo player a bad name, but you got to call him a name to get his attention every now and then. You know, that's the way it is. And Tony runs a program that I love to go up to when it works out that way and do a class in that section, in that place that he runs. There's another couple in there that I really respect. But it sounds like a mutual admiration society, but it is. I mean, that's what it is between me and him and Casey and I and Tony and Jen. I appreciate being asked to be here, and I want to do this way because I'll forget it, and I usually do, and I don't want to. Thanks to the speakers. I really, really, really mean that. Not only because I heard what I heard, and if I just keep myself focused, I always hear something worth remembering. But I've also done this for a long, long time, and I don't do it much anymore. But it takes a lot of work. It's a great, great honor to be asked to come. But it there's work to it. There's joy to it. There's love with it. But I really appreciate y'all being here. Yeah. I'm only sleeping with none of you, but I'm here to tell you that I really appreciate y'all. And I'm not going to tell you which one. Y'all work that out. Why is it always you that points to somebody else? Also very grateful to be here because this mountain has a lot of memories for me. I spoke here 30 years ago, and there are a lot of ghosts here. And I remember virtually all of them because almost all of them had an indelible imprint in my mind. In addition to that, I had three very strong men in my recovery, my partner in practice of medicine, and my sponsor, and the third man was an Episcopal priest, and my next door neighbor and best friend. We drank a lot of beer together, played a lot of golf together. He was a football coach that had a major experience in Korea, came home, went to seminary, and loved his God and loved his church. He could four-letter word, a three-foot putt that he missed better than anybody I've ever seen, make his amends walking off the green and do it again before he got to the next green, you know. But I mean, only sacred word that was never used was the Lord's name in vain. Other than that, every word was fair game, you know. And of course, I just loved him. I mean, we had a lot to talk about. And Jimmy was married to a girl who was born and raised here on Mount Eagle in the Assembly. Her daddy was the head of the English department at Swanee for a number of years, one of the agrarians. His name was Dr. Andrew Lytle. So we used to come down here a lot. It's been a wonderful time. Now, Jimmy's dead, and we don't see Pamela anymore. But those three men were absolutely, they would meet once a month or once every 2 months to talk about me. And that's just suited the hell out of me. Because I really knew that I had needed all the help I could get, and the fact that they were there and did that. So when we come down here, there's just all kinds of memories, and they're all good. So I'm really grateful to be here. What you've asked me to do is tell you what I was like, what happened, what I'm like today. As the years have gone by and I've looked at having done this many times, I realize what it basically is a 12-step call. It's a 12-step call on me, and it's a 12-step call on my sharing with you about me for a 12-step call on you. And I've never thought of that, never even begun to talk that way. But in this 12-step call, what I would try to talk with y'all about are the things, as best I can remember them for tonight, that have impacted me the most in my recovery. Hopefully there'll be some sequence to them. But the first thing that I remember that just rattled my cage was when I came home from treatment, and I had been in Atlanta, in Metro Atlanta Recovery Residence Program down there. Right after Ridgeview for a month, and MAR program for 3 months. And of course, they drilled me with the idea that we had a disease, and they drilled me with the idea that it was a spiritual solution. But when I got home and got my sponsor immediately, and we sat down to talk, and he said, you know, I never need to tell you for sure, you got a disease. And I looked at Jim, and I said, I don't give a damn. Just teach me what I need to know not to drink. And he looked at me and he said, let me tell you something, son. He's up almost 20 years older than me. Surrogate daddy, basically. And like most sponsors, in the best case scenario, seem to be. And he looked at me and he said, you know, you better give a damn. He said, I haven't known you very long, but I can tell right now, you'll get so spiritual one day, you'll be at risk to get drunk. And I remember looking at him, and I've never forgotten it. I have never forgotten it. It's expanded to all the other things that will do the same payoff in the brain chemistry that alcohol does. And the risk of doing that in easier, softer ways. But I've never forgotten. And the other thing he said to me, he said, we're going to teach you how not to drink. And you're a doctor, so what you're going to do is you're going to stay right on top of everything that this disease develops, is what we know about it scientifically, and teach us if we want to know about it. He said, that's what you owe us. And I thought, okay. And I've done that. And I got to tell you cold, hard facts. Silkworth was right. The allergy is just basically what was an intelligent comment, an intelligent observation you made because of an abnormal reaction. But at least I do have just a stone cold disease that is illustrated by irritable, restless, discontented, and what happens when I drink. It also happens when I work my ass off 18 hours a day. It also happens when I look for that money that you talked about today. It also happens from talking from the podium for a number of years and realizing there came a time when I needed to get the hell down from that podium because everything about my motive in staying there was suspect. And talking with my sponsor and whatnot, I took my roadshow home, and that's where it stays most of the time, except for very special places. And this is a very special place. And there are some others, but not many like this. Sex. Relationships. Wilson, the profundity of his putting a section in there on sex. I mean, you and I could have said, why didn't you put it in there on money? And nobody would have read it. I still think he'd have done a better job if he put pictures in there along with the section. Nobody would have admitted looking at the pictures, but we would have all done it. But he put that in there. And today what we know is that each one of those things in their own way create the change in brain. We've known this now since the 90s, decade of the brain, and now with the human genome. And all those other things create to heal the deficiency of the brain chemistry problem that we have that makes us irritable, restless, discontented. And we do these things and we're not irritable, restless, discontented, at least for 15, 20 minutes. You know? So I'm just telling myself again, and I'm not manipulating you. I'm reminding me that I have a disease, and any of y'all that don't either know it or have decided it's not that important. Big Book makes it really important. And I go to an awful lot of meetings. My home group is a men's meeting on Tuesday night. I don't know how many times we get the guys in there. We'll have 100, 125 men in that meeting. And every time somebody comes up, anybody got a problem? Yeah, you know, before we get into the book, if nobody has a problem, and we'll almost or frequently get somebody talking about that they got drunk or they're trying to come there to get sober. And we'll hear at least 45 minutes, and I'm grateful we do, of God talk. And I'm grateful we do. Until I finally at the end say, let me tell you about the fact that we got a disease. I mean, it's not whether I think it's important or not. I mean, that's what the book says, and working with others starts out, tell him they have an illness. And silk worth to find it. And I live it in that disease every day. Even when I'm, like right now, feeling pretty good, I'm right about a hair away from being irritable, restless, and discontented. Every minute. Now, maybe you're not. So that's the first thing that impacted me, is I have a disease which has no cure, as we know today. And the book tells us that, but is eminently treatable. And I do what y'all tell me to do, and I can, on one a day at a time, deal with the irritable, restless, and discontented without having to do crazy stuff. I do a lot of crazy stuff, but don't do as much as I'd do if I didn't do that. Now my privilege is to talk with you about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like to get to the point of having a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps to deal with that disease. I grew up just north of Parrish, Tennessee, in Union City, in a little town called Mayfield in western Kentucky. I grew up in a home where there was no alcohol and there were no drugs. My grandfather, the man for whom I'm named, died drinking bleach in the Mayfield City Jail. My mother was molested physically, emotionally, and sexually in that home. She is what we call today an adult child of an alcoholic. Now, if anybody has a problem with that nomenclature, and it really did get twisted in case he talked about that back when it first hit the scene. But you read the first page of the chapter of the family afterwards, and if you're around one of us, you get neurotic. And my mama was oh God, I love that woman. She died in 1978. She was 64 years old, and I was talking to somebody earlier how much we miss our mamas. And there's a lot of white hair on both of us, and how much we miss our mamas, and I really miss my mama. And I sat with my sponsor about 3 days ago for about 3 hours talking about the grief and the loss, not the resentment, the gratitude, but the grief and the loss of my mama. My mama was just like me. She's about half a stride in front of a fit all the time, and very impulsive, but God, what a neat lady. But she was really scarred with all the stuff that went on in that home. And there was no way to deal with it in the 30s or in the 20s. So she became, thank God, became a devout member of the church, and she took me to church with her. And that was, for 12 years, I never missed Sunday school and church, and it distinct cornerstone of my whole personality. And the whole deal was going to church. But our home was absolutely commandeered by alcoholism. Untreated alcoholism. Andrew talked about that side of the fence today, and anybody in Al-Anon can talk about it. Untreated alcoholism. The way it came out is my mother was steeped in shame and steeped in the whole idea that everybody in Mayfield knew she was the daughter of the town drunk. Now, I named for him. How many Burnses are there in the world? And I grew up in that town, and to my knowledge, nobody even knew who my grandfather was. If they did, they didn't seem to give a damn, you know. But Mama lived in that feeling that everybody knew who she was. And it came out in the old idea you talked about, the mascot child in the family, the family of alcoholics or alcoholic family. And I was the hero child. I was the first of two boys, and my mother lived vicariously through me. And the way it came out was I made my first and only B in 12 years of organized education when I was in the third grade. And I came home, and Mama didn't talk to me for 2 weeks. She didn't fuss at me. She just didn't talk to me. And you can bet your ass that's the only B I made in 12 years. Because my mama's approval meant everything in the world to me. It finally blossomed on into the approval of everybody. And when Wilson wrote Emotional Sobriety, which I think is the second best thing he ever wrote, that's just for me, after the big book, his whole deal in Emotional Sobriety was talking about his dependency on approval. Money, power, prestige, sex, approval. Remember when he said in his story, and I love this, when he said, I would show the world I was important. Boy, that's my story. I didn't know that I'd show the world I was important. Because we were poor, dirt poor. I was born in the Depression. Everybody was poor. Ate off of crate boxes. Most everybody did. But I was very bright, very sensitive. You know, most alcoholics live in 360-degree hypervigilance. I can tell you if somebody passed gas in Atlanta. I'm obviously exaggerating, but you know, that kind of hypervigilance. And I quickly picked up on the idea that we were poor. And I've spent most of my life running from poor. You know? I didn't belong to the country club. I caddied at the country club. And I was very aware of the fact that I was carrying the bags of boys whose daddies could afford to belong to the country club. I wasn't angry, but I was just aware of this thing that made me less than in my mind. This whole idea of that. And as I got my name in the paper more and more and more and more and more and things like that for what the thing, I mean, if you'd have seen my resume when I was in high school, you'd have thought one day I might be Pope, and I'm not even Catholic. I mean, I was a perfect kid. And I began to realize how much I enjoyed seeing my name in the paper and all that kind of stuff. Very subtly, but it evolved. Alcohol and drugs were no problem for me in high school and college. When I was the first Brady who ever went to college, at least out of that whole bunch of Bradys. And I can remember in high school, we'd go out maybe once a month and have a couple of beers, sing gospel songs, and go home and play Monopoly. I mean, that's what we did. In college, pretty much the same thing. Didn't have any problem with alcohol and drugs. Started medical school in 1958 at the University of Louisville School of Medicine. I was irritable, restless, discontented. I was flying apart. My whole idea about doctors is they lived on big hills, they had great big cars, and they were the town's heroes. And I, in my own mind, that was so far over my head, there wasn't any way I could deal with that. Couldn't even think about it. And so I got in there and got ready. It was bad enough in college, but boy, in medical school, it just, boom, hit me. And I was getting ready for my first gross anatomy exam, and I was so nervous I couldn't even study, and one of the guys is 2 years ahead of me in college, and he was 2 years ahead of me in medical school, came down and said, "Burns, how you doing?" And I said, I think I might as well leave. I'm too nervous. I can't study. And he said, "Here, take this pill. It'll help you stay awake." And that pill was called Dixoxin. It was the closest thing to commercial meth that's ever been made. It was amphetamine, but it was the most powerful amphetamine that could be made. And I took that pill, and my life's never been the same. I don't remember my first drink. Now, I'm a card-carrying, commode-hugging, 12-gauge shotgun in the mouth, 2 quarts of whiskey, and I'm drunk. But the first 12 years of my deal with addiction was with amphetamine, no alcohol. The last 8 years was alcohol, no amphetamine. And God knows I'm not anywhere close to even talking about singleness of purpose or anything else, but I am telling you I've worked with thousands of alcoholics and drug addicts in the prison, in the healing place, and with physicians. Thousands. And I got to tell you, the pure alcoholic and the pure drug addict just damn near doesn't exist anymore. I've sat and listened to these guys, and Tony can talk about this, and they'll sit there and say, "Yeah, I'm not an alcoholic, I'm a drug addict." Oh, hell yes, you're an alcoholic. You just haven't had enough to drink yet. Or, "I'm an alcoholic, you know, I'm not a drug addict." Yeah, you are, you just haven't had enough drugs yet. But every one of them leave and try something different. But they get back to the one that got them there, and then they come back. So my story, when I'm talking with them, I said, "I can explain this from a medical standpoint, but let me tell you my experience. You want to chance it? Be my guest. You want to chance it? Be my guest." So I started taking that drug, and I took it for the rest of the, and well, when I say my whole life changed, it was what was the first thing that my mind ever said, "Wow!" And I've never forgotten it. There's an area of the brain that houses PTSD, euphoric recall. That's just the way the brain's built. Now, we as having a cortex are just one step ahead of, you know, the lower animals. And so our cortex has to go through all sorts of interpretation, but at the lizard brain, that's where it is. And every memory is there. And under certain conditions, it will surface. We deal with it all the time. We deal with it all the time. My brain's never forgotten that, because what happened was I took that pill and the world got quiet. I never even knew it was loud. World got quiet. I was completely relaxed. I could do everything that I needed to do. And that was my answer. I got kicked out of medical school 2 weeks before graduation. In an amphetamine rage, I slapped one of my professors. They took me to the head of the Department of Psychiatry, and they sat down and looked at me, and he said, with the dean, said, "What's your problem?" I said, "I take too many drugs." And he said, "We can help you." And I said, "What are you going to do?" He said, "We're going to put you in intensive psychiatric therapy. You'll see two psychiatrists a week, one in Nashville, one in Louisville. And when they say you can come back, we'll let you back in." So for 2 years, I didn't take any drugs. I didn't drink. For 2 years, I didn't take any drugs. I saw those psychiatrists. We worked on everything we needed to work on, and finally at the end of 2 years, they signed my chit and said, "You can go back to school." And so they let me back in to repeat the senior year. Now, by this time, most of the guys that were residents, and residents run the hospitals. You know, there may be people that sit up in the upper offices and write out work charts, but the residents run the hospitals. And most of those residents were either in my class or had been there, and I was a horse's ass when I was on amphetamine. There are people who think I'm a horse's ass today. Well, that's their problem. I mean, that's their privilege, and they're welcome to think I'm a horse's ass today. And I may be. I don't think so, but I have to really watch it. In any event, I'd pissed a lot of them off, and they brought me in the residence and sat down and said, "We're going to see that you don't ever become a doctor. You don't deserve to be a doctor. and we want to make sure you don't. Did that cause me to be afraid? Oh, terrified. But I'm in here with this therapy word now that I know that I can name it. What is this I'm feeling? It's fear. Well, now you can handle it. Well, that isn't what happened. I walked back in that hospital in less than an hour, I strung out on amphetamine again. Didn't intend to, but the fear just gutted me. My classmates enabled me, and I finally graduated. Went into my internship and residency. Was strapped down four times in the mental hospital with IV fluids, straitjackets, padded cells. I might stay off amphetamine 6 hours, 6 days, 6 weeks, 6 months. Always went back in. Took me almost 2 years, or almost 3 years, to get that 1 year finished. Well, 2 years, actually. And then I got out and joined the Army. After a year being in the Army, I was in charge of the dispensary, and I had the key to the pharmacy. There were three doctors that ran the thing. So I'd just go in there and take handfuls of the amphetamine. And post commander came down, he was a bird colonel, small post, and he said, "Burns, are you taking that amphetamine?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "If you don't quit, we'll court-martial you." So I quit. Once he explained it to me, I quit, you know. Now, I'll tell you a story. When I was drinking, there came a time in my drinking that I couldn't stop drinking. I could always stop taking the drugs if they held a gun to my head. That's just my experience. I have no message on that. But I couldn't stay stopped because I didn't have a game plan. But I could stop as long as they were watching me and as long as they told me what was going to happen if I went back and did it. There came a time with drinking that was impossible. I didn't even consider stopping, and it was killing me. So I came home in 1969, got back on the amphetamine, started my practice, had a gallbladder attack. A good friend of mine took out my gallbladder. Another good friend was the internist, and we sat down at one of the hospitals in Louisville and held hands and prayed that I'd stop taking amphetamine, and I took my last one in 1969. Then I started drinking. The first 5 years of my drinking, almost 6 years of my drinking, were just outstanding. I had a ball. Had a great time. I hated my wife. She hated me. That marriage was, she's the first person I ever had sex with, and I was the first person she ever had sex with. And we went to our preachers, and they told us we had to get married. And we said, "We're freshmen in college." They said, "We just got to stay together till you can afford it, and then get married." So we stayed together for 3 years, got married, and lived together for 7 years married, and she hated me, and I hated her. And we really were hateable on both sides of the fence. I mean, that's just the way it was. She was taking care of a kid, and I was married to Attila the Hun's sister. That's the way it was, you know? This was a mean woman. She's still a mean woman. I mean, there isn't any way around it. I've grown up some, you know, some. But she ain't ever got any sweeter. She's just mean. And so I drank enough whiskey between 1970 and 1974 or three that she kicked me out of the house. And boy, I was happy. I was really happy. I bought me a white Corvette with a light blue interior and got me a light blue leisure suit and got me a whole case of Chevy's Regal Scotch and a sterling silver mint julep cup, and I was the party. I mean, I really was, and I was fun to be around. I had fun. I was serially monogamous. I mean, I never dated. I was. I mean, that's the best word for it. I never dated two women at the same time. I would date one woman, and then that wouldn't work for one reason or another, and I'd date another woman. And there's no question, as I've looked back and at what went on, I was looking for another wife, another mother, another somebody. But I had enough sense that when it didn't work, I didn't try to make chicken salad out of chicken manure. I just moved on, you know? And then I met Casey. And I met Casey, and I thought, just like she said last night, it was just, from the beginning, this was right. It's proved to be right to this day. And we've had to do a lot of work on it individually, collectively, therapy, AA, the whole deal. It's taken every bit of it for us to grow up, but we knew what we had in each other. And I had one date, as she said, and I summarized it and moved in with each other. And I lived with her and her roommate, who was a woman, and my brother, who's 8 years younger than me, he's dead now, but he was in AA 25 years, and I remember he came over to see me one time when I was living with those two. He found out some way or another I was living with the two women. So he came over to me and to see me, and I said, "Hey, Al Junior, how you doing?" "I'm doing fine. Let's sit down in the car and talk." "What the hell are you doing?" "What am I doing?" "You're living with two women." "Well, so what's your point, you know?" "Well, what are you doing?" "Nothing bad." "Well, explain that to me." And I thought, okay, I mean, I was his big brother, but all of a sudden he had me grilled. And so I finally he met Casey and was convinced that this was on the up and up and whatnot. And so, you know, that began our relationship, praise God. I thought at the time she was the most special person, not just woman, but the most special people I'd met. And I still think so. I mean, I still think so, you know? So we drank together, drink for drink. We raised a lot of hell. We had a lot of fun and ran with a lot of good people. And then I got really bad sick. I went over that edge pretty quickly. The last year of my drinking was just totally catastrophic, but the last 6 months was just... Every movie that's ever been made about alcoholism could have been made about me in that last 6 months. I can start my day anytime that I want to start it, but I always started at 11 o'clock in the morning. I would be lying in a recliner because I wouldn't go to bed. I thought if I don't go to bed, I won't wake up, and if I don't wake up, this won't start again today. And so Casey would come in at about 3 or 4 in the morning crying and say, "Please come to bed." And I said, "I'm crazy. I'll just drive you crazy. Get away from me. I'll drive you crazy." And she'd cry and go in there and go to bed. And I'd wake up about 11 o'clock the next day where I'd either passed out or whatever happened. She'd be gone to work. I'd get up and take a couple of Valium to stop shaking. And then I would take off to the hospital to make hospital rounds. And then I'd go over to my office to see the patients. When I came back from treatment, one of my biggest worries and one of my greatest fears was that I'd hurt somebody. And I had one partner at that time, and he and I sat down and reviewed all of my records for the previous 5 years. And I practiced quality medicine. I mean, nobody's perfect, but there wasn't anything in there that wasn't in it. Quality assurance from the hospital, the whole deal. Of course, that was a great relief to me. But I really have always been very grateful that I'm a doctor. I've been very grateful to be a doctor. I really love practicing medicine. I really love taking care of my patients. I was a family doc and after that for 25 years. And after 1 year of delivering babies and taking care of newborns, I decided I wanted to go into adult diagnostic medicine. I'd had that almost 2 years of internal medicine training, so that's what I did for 24 of those years, was adult diagnostic medicine. And I was well trained, and I stayed on top of my game, and I did a good job. But by this time, I knew in my own mind I wasn't a doctor anymore. I was a technician. I would race through the hospital rounds, get over to the office. My nurse would have the charts sitting in the rack. If you've been in the doctor's offices, you know what I'm talking about. And I would come in and take the chart out and look at it. And I was a family doctor. I knew these families. And I would take the chart down and I'd look at the chief complaint. And I would walk in and I would examine the patient. Then I would order my test. The test would come back and I would look at the test all in the same setting. And then I would write the diagnosis, write out the prescriptions, give them to the nurse, and she'd go in and talk to the patient. And I'd never said a word to the patient during that whole time. And that just gutted me. The reason I hadn't is because I had about 3 hours to get home because I was going into DTs. And I knew that's about the time I had. So I would race home, and Casey would come home early and fix me a broiled steak and baked potato because I was a doctor and knew I had to save my liver. And so I would eat right. And then I would sit down with my 2 quarts of whiskey and my 2 records for the evening. The first was the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, the Philadelphia Philharmonic Orchestra doing the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Mine eyes have seen the glory of... And I just cried and played for about 8. I love that song. I still cry. It's a great song. Then I'd take that one off and put on Neil Diamond's I Am, I Cried. Neil was my hero. Neil had a real drug problem in the 70s. And in this particular song, he says, I've got an emptiness deep inside and he won't let me go. I'm not a man who liked to swear, but I never cared for the sound of being alone. That was my story. Total isolation in a football stadium or wherever. Just total isolation. And then I'd go to the recliner. Casey had gone to work that morning, and I got up, and I sat there, and I knew it was over. I mean, I knew it was over. I didn't have a clue what to do. I'd had 9 years of psychiatric therapy, been deacon in 5 churches, and had never heard of AA, but I knew it was over. And I asked God to help me. You know, remember in the book it says, faith alone is insufficient? In the chapter Working with Others, faith alone is insufficient. I had faith, but in the book it said it must be followed by self-sacrifice and unselfish constructive action. Self-sacrifice, steps 1, 2, and 3. And unselfish constructive action, 4 through 12. Faith alone is insufficient. I had faith. God lived on a cloud and looked like Charlton Heston, the Tooth Fairy, and the Easter Bunny, and Santa Claus. He ran heaven, and my job was to run earth. Now, I'm summarizing, but that's what it was. If there's anything that this program, and there are many things it's done, but the program, the steps, the whole deal, the simple kit of spiritual tools, a sponsor, meetings, and the big book and the 12 steps, that's a simple kit. Call it what you want to, but that's what it is. And that simple kit of spiritual tools, I really do have a dialogue and have a communication between the God of my understanding and my job. And it's really very pleasant. But at that time, I knew that when I'd go to heaven, however I got there, he'd be there to meet me. But he wasn't going to come down here. And he wasn't going to send a chariot. And he wasn't going to let me ride the Greyhound bus. However I got there, he wouldn't do shit with me until I got there. That's where I lived. But I asked him to help me, and I knew immediately what I had to do, and I walked in, or what I thought he told me to do. I walked into my bedroom, got my 12-gauge shotgun, and put it in my mouth, and I was going home. I just wanted it to stop. Everything about it, I just wanted it to stop. And I was sitting on the side of the bed, and I said, God, if you don't want me to pull this trigger, give me a reason. It was 10 years in this program, and if time permits, I'll get there to tell you why it was 10 years in this program before I realized how crisply and clearly he answered that prayer. I said, give me a reason not to pull this trigger. And immediately what I thought of were my children. I had 2 children, a daughter, and I have a son. They're both in their 50s now. Both of them had a substantial period of time in AA. I know one of them has decided that after over 30 years in AA, she decided she doesn't need AA anymore. And, you know, that's the way it is. And the boy left with almost 30 years, and I hear that he's going back. Neither one of them will speak to me. I've done my inventory on both of them, and done everything that any of us would do in this program with my sponsor, with my prayers, the whole deal, and cleaned up everything that I can possibly clean up, and it is where it is. So for one day at a time, that's the way it is. Am I happy with it? Well, of course not. Do I think I need to go in there and start making amends for root rot Vietnam and the failed Christmas? I didn't cause those things. It's not there. And this is the kind of thing that this whole program is built for dealing with these kind, at least in my experience, dealing with these kind of issues to decide what is God's will and what I'm supposed to do with the best help I can get. And maybe you and I won't agree on what God's will is for that. But there is a process. Clearly demarcated in the book and clearly demarcated in the fellowship to arrive at, for that day and that time, what is the best decision in God's world. But he had me think of my children. They were small at that time, and I'd been in practice for about 8 years, and I had seen a number of people who had come in wondering why Daddy didn't love them enough that he killed himself, or why all this happened. Why weren't they loved enough? All of the stuff that they were carrying with them about just what I was getting ready to do. And I thought, if I pull this trigger, those babies will never know that I loved them. They'll never know. They'll just assume Daddy didn't love them. And that 10 years, when I asked God to give me some reason not to pull a trigger, he had me think of another human being. Now, they happen to be my kids. But aren't we taught in this whole program that our main purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and our fellow man? That's what it said. You know, right after what we have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition, the next thing I don't hear that much is, how can I best serve thee? This is a thought which must go with us every day. It's a working part of the mind, a God consciousness, a sixth sense. I'm not just quoting the book. This is part of my life every day. These thoughts are, you have drilled them in me through this book and through the support system and my sponsor and the whole deal. How can I best serve thee? Fit myself to be of maximum service to God and my fellow man. At that time, God had me think of another human being. And my thoughts were, they'll never know if I love them. I cared more about the pain I would cause them than the relief of my own pain. And that is a major impact point in my life. A major impact point that, for that moment in time, based on what I asked God to give to me, I cared more about the pain I would cause them than the relief of my own pain. If we could help each of us to reach that point, there wouldn't be any more relapses. There wouldn't. You know, alcoholism is a chronic relapsing illness. Well, not in my book. It's a chronic illness, and relapse isn't necessary, but if it happens, it's the best thing in the world to learn from that I know. But it isn't necessary. I'm crazier than a goat. I've never had a relapse. If anybody deserved to have one from just being crazy, I should have had 6 or 7 in the last 2 days. You know? It's almost like, whatever. We give people permission to relapse. They don't need permission. They're already hurting enough that they're looking for relief, and that's what they're going to find unless we give them something else, and they're ready to listen to it, ready to take it. Laid the gun down. The whole terror came back. I called a good friend of mine who was a psychiatrist, and the first God of my understanding was 5'9", wore glasses, and stuttered, and was a psychiatrist. Met him in his office almost immediately. I said, David, I'll do anything you tell me to do. I'll do anything you tell me to do, and I meant it. And he said, you've got to go to treatment. I said, where do you want me to go? And he told me. I called Casey, and I mean, my whole life was wrapped up in Casey. And I called Casey, and I said, Case, I've got to go to treatment. I'm really sick. And if you don't want to wait for me, then I understand. But I was willing to give up Casey, and I'm not sure I'm willing to give her up today. I think I would. And when I was in treatment, they met her, and they said, she's just everything you said she is. She'll be the greatest asset and the greatest liability to your recovery. But I was willing to give her up. I really meant it. I called my partner, and I said, if you don't want to be in practice with me anymore, I understand. I've got to go. The second higher power was the guy who ran the treatment center. I walked in and I said, Dr. Talbot, you tell me what to do and I'll do it. My third higher power, the one that I got the messages from over the telephone, was my sponsor. And I came home and I prayed all the time. And it did create a difference in my attitude, but my messages on what the marching orders were came over the telephone. I was absolutely obedient for 10 years. If this man told me to go stir poop Fourth and Broadway and then eat it, I'd have gone down there and asked how much you got. And that's just my way of making emphasis. Now, a lot of the stuff he told me, and I'll outline some of that, was just kind of weird. But it didn't matter. During those first 10 years, what I had was a three-step program with abject obedience and complete surrender to the fact that if I'm alone, I die. Came home from treatment, and the first 2 years were absolutely the most confusing periods of time in my life. Bill Wilson wrote about it. He was the first person to write about what we know the post-acute withdrawal syndrome. Remember in his story when he said for a year and a half he couldn't get a job because he was racked with waves of self-pity and resentment? 1979, medical science gave all the scientific information to say that for 6 months to 3 to 4 years, and this is with alcohol, sure, every drug has a withdrawal process, but alcohol in the adult alcoholic is damn near you can set your watch by it. Now, in the adolescent alcoholic, that's not true. You know, the big book wrote about young people drink differently from older people. And today, we not only do we know that, we know why. But in the adult alcoholic, you can almost set your clock by 6 months to 2 to 3 years. Simple problem solving, stress management, sleep patterns, antegrade memory, all screwed up. All screwed up, not retrograde. If you know how to ride a bicycle, you can still ride a bicycle. If you don't know how to ride a bicycle and you try, you're going to have a tough time. Why do you think we put the healing place in for a year? Because we had the money to do it, and it gave us time to work with a brain that was just simply going to be toxic from the physical effects of the alcohol. I could practice medicine, but I couldn't find my car in the parking lot. I would call my sponsor 5, 6, and 7 times a day for almost 2 years. I was fine in an examining room, but I'd get lost walking between them. That's an exaggeration, but you know my point. That's why I was obedient, because nothing else made sense. Nothing else made sense. So that was the fellowship Casey and I got with this guy and with 5 other couples, and we absolutely ran together night and day. Went to meetings together, cooked out in each other's houses on weekends. I mean, the only 2 of us left, they all died sober. But the fellowship was indescribably wonderful, as none of us could park our cars. But God, we fell in love with each other and we did it. When Casey and I got, when I came back from treatment, we got together and Casey came hooked at my hip. Everywhere I went, she was right on my hip. She went to open AA meetings with me, did all those things like that. I mean, we were inseparable in this fellowship and with each other. When she got to be about 7 years sober, she switched and came and cuddled up with me on the couch and said, I need to go to AA. And I said, I think that's great. But I mean, she didn't even, everything about it, it was a great life because I wanted, everything I wanted Casey to do, I just had to tell her and she'd do it. I didn't know all that, but that's what it was. Absolute control, absolutely. And we were all together having fun. We were. Then she got this new sponsor in AA, and the sponsor said, Casey, is being Burns' wife everything you want out of life? She said, yeah, that's okay. But she said, I'd really like to go back to college. She only had about a year. And Bonnie said, why don't you do that? And she said, I don't think Burns would like it. She said, why don't you go ask him? She came and settled down with me on the couch, and she said, Burns, I want to go back to college. I said, I think that's great. A minute. I said, absolutely. She said, I want to be a therapist. And go back to college. 2 months later, I was really pissed. The lights weren't on when I'd get home at night. My meals weren't cooked because she'd be down there. That was resentment. Remember, now I'm talking about I lived on a three-step program because we weren't taught to read the big book. We were taught to not drink, go to meetings, get a sponsor, tell him what's wrong with you, he'll tell you what to do, and then go save a drunk. That muddle middle wasn't even a part of us. My first fourth step at home, it was at 2 years, my sponsor contacted Hazleton and had them send him 300 questionnaire. I've answered the questions, and my fifth step was telling him. Going to 7 meetings a week. The guy that I told you, the Episcopal priest here, I went to him, my next door neighbor and best buddy. I said, Jimmy, take me back to my church. He said, I can do that, but you got to go to AA. They have more success with alcoholics than we do. But I administered the chalice and the host. We ran the youth group, the whole deal. We were deeply involved in the church and deeply involved in AA. But no big book. No steps. So I went to Jim and I said, Jim, I'm pissed because Casey's blah, 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 blah. And he said, pray for her. We hear that all the time. But he didn't say how to pray for her. He didn't say list what's threatened. He didn't say the prayer is how can I help her. Anybody that I'm sponsoring, when they come to me with resentment, it's because that's what the book said. How can I help her? Now, I want her to have $10 billion, a new car, but I have an airplane, and you know, whatever. Then I got scared. I thought somebody, Casey will find a real stud down there, and she'll leave me. I'm 14 years older than she is, and I said, and I thought, that's not her style. But somebody may drag her off in the bushes and rape her. And I went to Jim and I said, Jim, I'm afraid something will happen to her. He said, well, ask God to help you. I had all the money in the world at that time that I could ever thought there was money in the world. I had all the professional prestige. I had everything. But then I decided that one of the nurses in my office had to be one of the prettiest women I'd ever seen. And I started a whole fantasy around that. I realized I was getting real sick about that whole fantasy. And it's the first thing I'd never talked to my sponsor about. The reason I hadn't talked to it because I had a game plan and didn't know it where that was going. And I remember sitting there thinking, I've got a secret and I'm lying. What happens to people in AA who have secrets and lie? You know, we read how it works in the first paragraph. Anybody can get it if you can be honest. Nobody can get it if you can't. And we drill each other with, you're only as sick as your secret. You know, we got to be entirely honest with somebody. So I called him and I told him, and he called her and told her. Now, when I'm working on the class at the healing place and I say, this is what happened, what should I have done with him? And they'll say, shoot the zombie, kill him, let the air out of his tires, set fire to his house. I'm saying, absolutely, understand every one of those. Now we're going to see what the program, and then we go through the whole drill, the columns, and everything that's there. Everything to get to the point of dealing with that. But the whole idea was killing. When I got home that night, and let me tell you, I absolutely adore this man. We only spoke twice after that. I changed all my meetings, changed my sponsor, all within 2 weeks. If there's anything that is absolutely sacrosanct and sacred in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's confidentiality and trust. We got nothing without that. We got nothing. But I thank God for that man all the time. He was exactly what I needed. I was a doctor. Every single day I had 40 to 50 people telling me I was the greatest thing since cod liver oil. whether they believed it or not, that's what they were telling me. My patients, my staff, the nurses at the hospital, and Jim called me Mr. Brady. Took my cards away from me. Now, looking at it now, you think, this guy brutalized you. He sure as hell did, but God knew I needed brutalizing, I guess. Because I learned obedience, and I learned it well. He was exactly what I needed. Nobody else has to agree with that. I'm not even sure I'm right. But I know what worked for me. I know what worked for me. When I walked in the house, Casey said, Jim called and said that you're having an affair. And I said, it's a fantasy. And what I remember, she said, do you love me? And I said, more than anything. You want to work on this marriage? Yes. And so we went into therapy, and we spent 3 years in therapy looking at some things that everything, where the bullets were coming from. At the same time, what I did is I said, God, my sponsor's gone. I don't know what to do. I'll get a new one. What I don't know what to do. He's always tell me what to do. And a little sponsee of mine came up with 8 tapes and handed them to me and said, would you listen to these and see if they're any good? And they were Joe and Charlie's. Big book tapes. I listened to those tapes and cried all the way through because I saw what a 12-step program was and I had a 3-step program. 11 of the guys just turned out to be those numbers that were in the same meetings with us left and came with me, and we started all these new meetings. We took those tapes and our book, and we did a big book study. It took us about 3 months to do a big book study listening to those tapes. To my knowledge, it was the second big book study that ever happened in Louisville. That was in 1987. Today, there are 40 or 50 or 60 going on at all time, and they came out of that. AA in Louisville has changed from a personality program to a personality program and a big book program. I remember sitting there when I realized that, I said, God, why did you leave me out here? I could have gotten drunk. I could have died. I could have left Casey. I could have. Why did you leave me out here? And I felt his voice say, son, you may impress a lot of people with what you know, but you're going to help heal a lot of people with your experience. Don't ever, ever give a talk again to anybody, individual or group, where you don't tell them the difference in a 3-step program and a 12-step program and how it worked in your life. So that's what I'm doing. That's what I'm doing. Where am I today? I made my amends to Casey. I made my amends. While I never slept with the other woman, I made my amends to her for a lot of the things that I had inferred would go on. I made my amends to anybody that needed in that process, because with the new sponsor, we went through all of that. Where am I today? I believe with absolute conviction that every problem I've got is a result of the second half of the first step. Trying to control the outcome of anything or the behavior of anybody. And I believe that every solution I've got to the second half of the first step is a 12-step solution. Not just 4 and 5, not just 6 and 7. It's a 12-step solution, starting with step 1, first half of step 1. Do you really believe you're powerless over alcohol? Yeah, I really do. Well, then you damn well better get your crap together right now, because you're trying to run the world, and you're going to get sick, and you're going to get crazy, and then you're going to get drunk. And go right on down the line. Lack of power, turn it over. This have very little permanent effect, unless at once followed by an effort to see what's blocking us. Self-centeredness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And go right on through the deal. Settle all my accounts. I believe with complete conviction, at least in my life today, what that works for me is what Tony talked about, that as alcoholics, we are undisciplined. We allow God to discipline us in the way we just outlined. And you can go back either to the first step, or you can go wherever you want to. You can respond wherever. You don't have to do anything with it. But the bottom line is, it's there. I start my morning on awakening. I go to bed at night on retiring. Throughout the day, the first paragraph of the 10th step. We face self-centeredness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. What do? We ask God to remove. We talk to somebody and make our amends. We help somebody. My God, it's so simple. It just eludes us rocket scientists. But most of all, it just doesn't have the discipline that's in there unless I really buy it and get involved and get engaged and buy everything about this program with no reservations, because even then I'm going to get just sloppy as hell sometimes. But that's the deal. Every problem I've got is a first-step problem, and every solution I've got is a 12-step solution to deal with the discipline. Everything is about self-centeredness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. In the book, self-centeredness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Oh, he threw in selfish sex conduct and harms to others, and we have to do that. But those aren't character defects. Those are the result of character defects. They are absolutely the result for me. I mean, for me. So I'm finished. Probably not as soon as some of you would have liked. Absolutely not even finished. I'm not even ready to quit. But the fact of the matter is, it's time. It slipped a little bit there for a minute into, maybe more than a minute into preaching. I don't mean to slip into preaching. But I preach because I have such passion and conviction, and I know from a conversation I had with somebody tonight that I have occasionally pissed people off with that. And I sure as hell didn't mean to. I sure as hell didn't mean to. The last thing on earth for somebody who needs somebody else's approval as bad as I do, I don't intentionally walk around looking for people to piss off, but I do it a lot anyway, you know, and I don't mean to. I'm so grateful. As I say, I don't do this much anymore. But I'm so grateful for the invitation to be here. I'm so grateful you asked Casey to be here. We had a great trip down. We've had a great trip since we've been here. And this is a special place. And I love you with all my heart.